Roundtable Osteuropa. Ein Podcast des Zentrums für Osteuropa und internationale Studien.
Hello everybody, I'm glad to welcome you to our Roundtable Eastern Europe, the podcast of the Center for Eastern European and International Studies, CEUS for short. CEUS is an independent international and interdisciplinary research institute based in Berlin. It focuses on foundational and policy-relevant academic research on Eastern Europe and shares the results with policymakers, the media, and the broader public. Today we are going to talk about Russophone literature and culture. What this means, we will find out in a minute. But first, I would like to introduce my guests to you. I welcome Naomi Caffey from Reed College in Portland, Oregon, where she works as an assistant professor of Russian at the Russian department. Naomi holds a PhD in Slavic languages and literatures from the University of California. Her current project is a book entitled Russophonia, Writing the White Russian World. It's good to have you here, Naomi.
Thank you so much, Nina. It's good to be here.
I also welcome Konstantin Kaminski from Humboldt University in Berlin. Konstantin is a researcher at the Department for Slavic Studies. He holds a PhD in Slavic Studies and Eastern European History from the University of Konstanz. Currently, he works on a social history of the Russian ethnographic novel, but his research interests also include Eurasianism and the Russian world. Thank you, Kostya, for joining us.
Thank you, Nina. I'm so glad to be here today.
My name is Nina Fries. I'm a researcher at CEUS Berlin. No surprise, I also hold a PhD in Slavic Studies, and my latest project deals with Russophone literature and culture in the post-Soviet space. I am your host today. So let's get started. Before we will talk about Russophone literature and culture, we first should say a few words about Russophones in general. What is a Russophone? A Russophone person is first of all a person who speaks Russian, either natively or by preference. Sometimes the term is also used to describe a person whose cultural background is associated with Russian language, regardless of ethnic or territorial distinctions. The largest Russophone country is, no surprise, Russia, but for different reasons, such as migration, we have other countries with significant numbers of Russian speakers, both in the post-Soviet space and beyond, for example, in Israel. All in all, we talk about approximately 258.2 million people who use Russian either as a native or second language. Naomi, you are currently working on a book on Russophone literature. I guess I could hardly find a better person to answer my first question. What exactly is Russophone literature, and what is the difference between Russophone and Russian literature?
Well, in order to answer this question, I would like to start by first talking about how I came to differentiate Russian from Russophone literature. And this started when I was in graduate school at the University of California in Los Angeles. I discovered works of the Kyrgyz writer Chingiz Aitmatov and other writers from the Soviet Union who did not identify themselves as Russian, but who wrote in the Russian language about various topics and experiences that didn't necessarily have a straightforward relationship to a Russian ethnic or national identity. And so this is how I became interested in the interface of Russian and non-Russian identities and the interface of Russian and non-Russian cultures. I was also, at the time, comparing what I saw in this Russian language literature of the Soviet Union with what I was learning about global Anglophone and Francophone and Lusophone literatures. The study of these literatures takes into consideration the effects that empires have on the languages that people use to express themselves and the various ways that identities can be made and unmade and put together and fragmented and rearranged as a result of different types of power dynamics and needs for communication. So, how I came to differentiate Russophone literature from Russian literature was exactly in this way. Russophone literature is a useful designation, a useful framework for us to approach literature that's written in the Russian language, and this is a vast literary field. There's many people who are residents of many different countries around the world who write in the Russian language, but have varying degrees of distance from an ethnic or national Russian identity. And so this is where I would begin to approach the difference, but of course it's very complicated when we think about the history of what a Russian ethnic or national identity is to begin with. It's something that emerged out of diversity. And even the most classic canonical Russian writers, those writers who are responsible for Russian literature with a capital R, are themselves sometimes not fully Russian or are associated with multiple identities in addition to Russian. And I'm thinking here about Nikolai Gogol, who's famously writing in between Russian and Ukrainian identities. But there are many other such examples. And so the question about why this is a promising research field, I think at this moment, transnational literature is becoming more visible, just as issues of migration and issues of multiculturalism become more and more relevant all the time due to globalization and a lot of other interesting geopolitical situations that we find ourselves in these days. And a lot of the research in comparative literature dealing with global Anglophone or Francophone or Lusophone literature also points in this direction. This is what's known as the transnational turn in literary studies. And so I think the kind of research that I do and the kind of research that you, Nina, and Konstantin also do can contribute in a very meaningful way to discourses that are already going on about transnational literary traditions and hybrid identities and the otherwise complicated ways that our lives no longer really correspond to lines on the map that were drawn in the 19th and 20th centuries.
Yeah, sure. Naomi, could you give us some examples for contemporary Russophone authors? Mm-hmm. Because you already mentioned
yes.
Gogol, but
yes.
It was quite a time ago that he wrote.
Yeah. So as I mentioned before, the author that got me started thinking about all of these questions was the Kyrgyz writer Chingiz Aitmatov, who I understand is actually quite popular in Germany and has been translated into German and is widely read and even lived until the end of his life in Germany. But in addition to writers of his generation, and these writers include the Kazakh writer Alzhas Suleymanov, the indigenous writer from the Russian far north, Yuri Retko, the Abkhazian writer Fazil Iskander, the Azerbaijani writer Chingiz Khuseynov. These are what I understand to be kind of a fundamental step forward that happened in Russophone literature, and this is in the late Soviet era. And their works represent a real flourishing of this tendency, which was encouraged by the Soviet government's literary apparatus. And then the situation grows in complexity and it becomes much more interesting after the Soviet Union falls apart because identities come to be rearranged in different ways. And so some of the authors that I focus on include the Tashkent School of Poetry and the Fergana School of Poetry. Both of these schools have their origins in late Soviet and then post-Soviet Uzbekistan. Although the practitioners of these movements live around the world, many of them have emigrated to the Russian Federation and are based in Moscow now, still identifying themselves as Central Asian writers and writing works that are very much grounded in Central Asian history and literature and culture. So actually, for the past few years, I've been gradually excavating meaning from the Tashkent and Fergana schools, and I've also become very interested in circles of contemporary writers based in Almaty and Astana, Kazakhstan. We have a few favorites in common. I think Nina, Yuri Serebryansky, who's a multiple prize-winning author, Ilya Adyagov and Aygerim Taji, and Pavel Banyakov. And up until now, I've worked primarily with poetry in terms of the contemporary writers that I study, but I think there's a lot of different genres and even genres of performance that I'm interested in. So there have been some interesting projects put on by a theater in Moscow called Teatr Dok, which advances its own aesthetic of documentary style theater and has put on some interesting genre bending performances by migrant workers themselves, focusing on the theme of post-Soviet labor migration and starring people from former Soviet republics who have found themselves in these kinds of situations. And in general, this leads to the last point that I want to make about Russophone literature in general, which is that it is as vast and diverse as the world is, really. There are as many different ways of being a Russophone and being a Russophone writer as there are Russophone writers and performers. And I find Moscow to be a place that is just as much brimming with the possibilities for investigating Russophone works as, for example, Central Asia or the Caucasus, former colonial outposts of the Russian Empire.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, so let's move on. Well, there's a lot of Russophone literature that occurs beyond Russian borders. And I'm interested in a question, how, if at all, this literature or generally spoken culture that occurs outside Russian borders is recognized in Russia? Maybe, Konstantin, could you tell us a little bit about this question?
Well, thank you, Nina. So let's go back 10 years ago, as we witnessed in Russia, a growing number of far-right activists and anti-migration movement. And it was basically between 2008 and 2012. So we remember after Vladimir Putin came back to power in 2012, it's all stopped. Not suddenly, but gradually, the far-right movements in Russia stopped, and Russian government and Russian culture at all started this big project of Eurasian integration, which we mostly perceive as an economic integration, but which is nonetheless also a cultural integration. So what happened in 2013, first with the conflict in Ukraine, it could canalize all of these violent, radical, far-right young guys to fight in the eastern Ukraine, and Russia, Kazakhstan, Armenia, Belarus started their own project of Eurasian integration. And this is a point where a lot of, as I would say, very diverse popular culture occurred. So we started to witness more and more guys from Central Asia on Russian TV shows, on Russian entertainment shows. And we have a process that the Russian show business, it was skyrocketing. And it was also diversifying very much. So we had a lot of Kazakhstani comedians, of Kazakhstani singers, of Armenian stand-up comedians occurring in Russian TV shows, but also touring through the whole Russian-speaking counties in CIS counties. So the question, so how is this Russophone popular culture, especially music, is recognized in Russia? So maybe let's have some sound bites from a very famous Kazakhstani rapper, Skriptonite, who was like a very big occurrence on the Russian music market around 2015 to 2016. And this is how he sounds like. Собаки лают, чей-то замок сломан. Здесь получат градус из металлолома. Так что, сука, я из низа. Мой голос пронизан дымом каннабиса, а не их шоу-бизом. Смотри в телевизор, там ты как Алиса. В стране чудес виза. В мой мир за 11 километров от города. So, as we can see, Skriptonite was amazingly popular in a Russian-speaking segment of Apple Music, Spotify, YouTube. It doesn't mean that he's just popular in Russia. It means he's popular in Ukraine, in Belarus, in Armenia, in Latvia, in Estonia, and those are all the countries he was touring with his with his concerts. Another amazing example is Dimash Kudaibergenov from Kazakhstan. He was actually discovered on a Chinese talent show, Singer 2017, and he made his career very, very quickly. So he's singing in 12 different languages, of course, his native language, Kazakh, as well as in Russian, Mandarin, English, French, Ukrainian, Italian, Turkish, Serbian, German, and Spanish. So, and he has, of course, a very amazing soprano voice. So you see that in today's Russia, and in my view, it's intrinsically bound to the Eurasian integration, we have more and more diversification of Russian speaking, of basically Russophone, show business and entertainment programs, which are filled from all over the Russian speaking communities from the post-Soviet countries.
Can I ask about how exactly these performers came to be so popular in the integrated Eurasian space? In other words, did the Eurasian integration create the demand, or was it a top-down process by which powerful media companies elected to promote artists and performers from the periphery of the Eurasian integration?
Well, thank you, Naomi. It's an important question. So I think the most striking point here, first, it's a bottom-up process, in my view, absolutely. And this is a process which is not bound to the points we have discussed before. It's not bound to the question of identity, to the questions of national identity or cultural identity. It's a question which is bound to the markets. So what did the Eurasian integration actually did? First, it created a narrative of integration. It was a first model of post-Soviet integration. It was a model of non-ideological integration. It was just about economy. And this is how the entertainment markets, showbiz markets, started to flourish. You can see the involvement of big companies. It's a top-down process, but it's a bottom-up process comparing to the political leadership. I don't think it's something which was triggered by politics. I think there is a very market-bound approach to it. It's just how the entertainment markets work. Young singers, talented singers from Kazakhstan, from Belarus, from Ukraine, from Romania, they need audiences. They want to tour outside their own country. They need big money, they need big auditoriums. They need people to whom they sing, and they need, of course, big labels who would promote them. And this is why they are going to this, not just Russia-centered, but also to this big Russophone showbiz market. Because they know very well they are not ready for international Anglophone markets. There's no way. In the Russophone markets, it's the ecosystem where they can grow.
So, Konstantin, you would say it's first of all an economic decision to sing, to perform in Russian, because you can reach the biggest audience with that. It's very interesting, because 2 years ago, I was in Moscow and interviewed the then chief editor of the literary journal Druzhba Narodov, People's Friendship, and he told me that it's always an individual, a personal thing why you decide to write, to perform, to sing in Russian. And I asked him this question, is it a question of economics? And he was, no, not at all. It's it's fate. It's something that happens in your life that brings you to the point in Russian. Oh, yeah. And I think we should consider this economic dimension when we're talking about Russophonia as well.
Mm. Yeah, that's a really important point, Nina, because I've heard almost the exact same thing from Russophone Azerbaijan writers. I've been told, well, the muses decide for me. And that's also actually interesting, and that's a significant aspect of Russophone literature as well. The fact that people who are writing it often are proficient in more than one language. Russian might be one of the many languages that a person has command of. And for some writers, it is a choice. For some writers, it's an aesthetic choice or an economic choice or an ideological choice. As it was for many Russophone Soviet writers.
Yeah, and today it might even mm-hmm. be an ideological choice not mm-hmm. to write in Russian, mm-hmm. as we mm-hmm. can see in today's Ukraine, where mm-hmm. people mm-hmm. who are fluent in both languages decide not to perform, not to speak in Russian mm-hmm. in public anymore.
Well, mm-hmm. yes, but there are also a lot of people, of artists in Ukraine who decide to perform in Russian, even after the conflict. The most famous is actually the presidential candidate Vladimir Zelensky. He's being criticized a lot for producing his shows, and he's producing a lot of shows. He's maybe one of the most visible drivers of Ukrainian pop culture and show business. But he didn't cease to perform and to produce in Russian, even if he was extremely critical of what was happening in Crimea or in eastern Ukraine, and it was also his choice. So I don't think it's a basically economic choice. I think it's a pragmatic choice. So we have a lot of bilingual artists. Let's go back to Kazakhstan. So when they start to perform, when they start to perceive themselves as artists in their hometown, in their county, they are first starting to reach local audiences. Mm. And they're performing in both, in Kazakh language and in Russian language. Mm-hmm. And they see for which kind of music they get more response or better response. Then when they're growing and reaching regional audiences, let's say from Pavlodar to Almaty, there are more Russian-speaking population is living, they of course starting to do more performances in Russian. When they get some certain level of visibility, they invited to tour in Russia, and Russia is the biggest market for Russophone mm-hmm. culture, for Russophone show business mm-hmm. after mm-hmm. all. So this is more like a pragmatic choice. It can be bound back to a choice of identity, but I really don't think it's that central for the most people. For people in culture, for writers, of course, absolutely. But I think when we speak about show business, those are another rules you live by.
I agree with that. Mm. Okay, we already touched the political dimension of Russophonia, so I would suggest that we go on this way a little bit further. Konstantin, could you tell us a little bit more about this political dimension? So how, for example, does the Kremlin use Russophonia, and for what purposes?
Well, let's go with one more sound bite at this point.
Oh, great.
And just hearing it. So I claim this is probably the most recognizable melody, it's a most recognizable tune all over the Russian-speaking world, meaning in Russia, in Ukraine, in Kazakhstan, but also in US, in Israel. Because, look, at some point, the Soviet anthem or the international ceased to exist in the mental perception of people. But this one, and this is an anthem of a TV show which started already in 1961, and which is a show which is broadcasting for now how much? From 1960 till today, it's a very long time. And everybody knows the show in Israel, in Germany, in Kazakhstan. Three generations of Russian-speaking people are listening to this. And of course, Kremlin is very, very aware that the Russian popular culture is the most valuable, the most powerful tool, not just for political communication, but also as a tool for soft power and public diplomacy. And I think the
Kremlin, you say, how do they support shows like this?
I'm just about to tell.
Okay, great.
So they're showing public support by occurring on the shows. But make no mistake, there is like a big network which connects the show, the TV channels, which are mostly in the hand of Kremlin or which are state-driven, plus prominent persons from political life like Medvedev, like Putin himself, like notable ministers, regularly occurring in the shows as guests and just showing their support. But in the end, I think, as Kremlin recognized, that popular culture's entertainment business is its most powerful tool in strategic communication, in public diplomacy, they arrived at a laissez-faire approach. Just let them do. Just let the showbiz markets care for themselves. So what we can do, what Kremlin or Russian administration actually does, is creating a framework for Russian popular culture to let them grow. To let them grow in innovations. So, and what we have experienced in just last 10 years, it's not longer than 10 years, that the Russian popular culture skyrocketed by adapting Western TV shows formats and adapting them for the Russian-speaking or Russophone markets. And I think this is mostly this laissez-faire approach which Kremlin is using in regard to the popular culture.
Hey, interesting. Naomi, would you like to add something to that point?
Yeah, it occurs to me an additional example that I recently saw another researcher give a presentation about, the alignment of the genre of chanson with the members of Vladimir Putin's political party and the presence of popular chanson singers, as well as songs that used to be extremely politically incorrect and underground and dissident in their content, being elevated to national stages. So they're being sung, these criminal songs are being sung by police officers, choirs, and they're making appearances, commemorating national holidays and things like this. So there seems to be this interesting resignification of certain cultural content in Russia, and I'm curious about whether this is part of the soft power of show business that you're speaking of. What more can you tell us, Konstantin, about the content of the popular culture?
Well, it's obviously complicated. So I have an idea about this. So for me, it's very, very interesting to look at how the popular culture and civil society interrogate. Because we are used to perceive civil society as something which grows from opposition, from dissidents, from NGOs. But for me, it's a big question. So how popular culture is co-working or to create a common sense in a society? So, for example, so we had some very big, bad underground rappers in the Russian culture who started their careers around 2008, 2010, and they are coming to being very, very popular within Russian audiences. So what are they doing today? Today, they are moderating large-scale popular shows on Russian state television. So a very, very prominent example is, for example, Shnur, the leader of the band Leningrad, or the then underground rapper from Rostov Basta, who also made his career of his from his standpoint of gangster rapper to a very recognizable figure on First TV channel.
That's amazing. I'm reminded of Kanye West meeting with Donald Trump recently in the United States.
Yeah, so I think all over the world. So if we speak about populism, populism is dependent on popular culture. So if you think back in the early 20th century, so as every dictator, Stalin, Mussolini, and Hitler, and after them, Gaddafi and Saddam Hussein, all of those guys were writing books. Why? Because a classical dictator has to show his mastery of the language in a written word, in a book. In today's populism, you don't need literal culture that much, but you need the popular culture much more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting. Okay, we are running a little bit out of time, so I think we should move over to my very last question. And I would like you to take a glimpse into the future. Since the number of Russian speakers in the post-Soviet space is declining, for different reasons and others than we could think after what we just have heard in this room, what do you think is the future of Russophone culture?
Well, it's interesting that we ended our discussion of popular music by talking about a transition from literary to oral media, or from literature to performance. I'm actually interested in what the boundary, what the end point might be for Russian literature in terms of this relationship between written and oral discourse. I'm curious, and I know that there's a current volume that has come out in the United States called Global Russian Cultures, which is discussing different forms of Russian identity around the world in the wake of globalization. And there's some interesting research in this volume about Russian identity of American writers of Russian background who may have been born in the Soviet Union or who are the children of immigrants, who still identify in some way with some of the common markers of Russian culture, and who mark themselves as writers to a reading public, as well as the characters and the content of their works as Russian, while writing in a language that is not Russian at all. So writing in English, in the case of, I think, some other German language writers, writing about Russian topics from a standpoint of Western Europe. So I'm interested in the possibility of Russophone literature or Russophone identities beyond the Russian language. Can there be an English-speaking Russophone writer who doesn't know Russian?
Okay, great. So this will be the future of Russophonia. But Konstantin, what's your suggestion?
I would go with this. So we have already some examples. For example, Levitska, she is a British writer. She's writing about Ukraine. We all remember the short history of Traktor in Ukrainian. She perceives herself as an Ukrainian writer, but she's writing in English. So maybe it's probable that it's going in this direction, like you say, Naomi. So on my part, I would like to stress another phenomenon which is taking place on the, let's say, identity markets or memory markets in Eurasia, and it's growing more and more competitive. So for example, if you can say today still, Russian is lingua franca in Eurasia. This is a language which helps people from Lithuania and people from Ukraine to communicate with people from Armenia or Uzbekistan. And this is like this. So, but today, there are a lot of another cultural directions who are offering their language, their product on these markets. For example, the Turkvision Song Contest, which is administrated and organized by Turkish Council, and offers singers, young singers from Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, a forum to present themselves and to integrate them in the Turkophone culture. So we see right beside Russophone cultures in Eurasia, we see Turkophone cultures emerging, also sponsored, also growing with their showbiz markets. And we have the same from Chinese. So we also have Confucius Institutes and Sinophone occurrences in the region. A lot of Kazakhi citizens of my age, they let their children learn Chinese, not Russian anymore, because they are calculating that China would be the more dominated language market, identity market, and of course economic market already in the near future.
Okay, thank you. So Russian language is under pressure, but somehow Russophone culture is going to continue. Naomi and Konstantin, thank you for being here with me, and thank you for listening.